Hello, welcome to the Latin JavaScript podcast. This is Manuel Lemos. As always, I'm here presenting this podcast, bringing what has been happening in the JavaScript world, along with my co-host, Michael Kimsel. Hello, Michael.
Hello, as usual.
How are you doing, Michael? What have you been doing as a good in the JavaScript world?
Well, JavaScript's okay. I've been, personally, I've been all right, just sort of been bogged down with too much work. Not necessarily a bad thing, but not a whole lot of breathing room. But we've got some, probably some cool JavaScript stuff to talk about as well. So back to you. Carry on.
Right. In this episode, we have a guest, Zachary Kessin. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Hello, Zach.
Yep. Hello, Matt. Hello. Hello from Israel. And yeah, you got it right.
Shalom.
Shalom.
Shalom, see?
Yeah, well, Michael is the expert on foreign languages.
I try. Say a few words in each language.
Okay. Zach is our guest because he is publishing a new book on JavaScript and HTML5. Right. Zach, can you give us an overview about the interesting point of your book?
So the book is Programming HTML5 Applications, and it's out currently in early release from O'Reilly. It'll be out in a final publication in August or September. And the theme of the book is that the web with HTML5 and JavaScript has become a really great platform for building applications, the type of thing that 5 or 10 years ago would have been a desktop application, but now can be delivered through the web. Sort of the obvious example of this is Google Docs, which is one of those things that I think we've all used and come to depend on to some level. But many other features have entered into HTML5 that are very useful for building applications. For both mobile and non-mobile sources. So that's sort of what I want to talk about.
Are you still there, Zach?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, you went out on my end. I'm not sure. Could you something about what used to be desktop applications, we rely on Google Docs. Could you repeat some of that after that?
Oh, sure. So with HTML5 and the new advances in the last couple of years of JavaScript, it's possible to build an application into the browser that does stuff that 5 years ago you just could not have done in a web browser. You can, for example, make a web page that will work even if you don't have a connection to the internet and can cache all the files locally and store data offline, and then when you come back online onto the internet, sync itself up with a server.
Right.
That you could not have done that 5 years ago. It just wasn't possible.
Yeah.
That's sort of one feature. Then there's web workers, because as you know, JavaScript runs a single thread of execution, or you can only have one thing running at a time. So with web workers, you have an actor model similar to what you might get in, say, Scala or Erlang, where you have your main thread running in the browser, and it can access the DOM and do all those fun things. But then you can create a second process, or more than one if you like, running off in the background that it has no shared memory. It can't access the DOM. It can't access any of the global objects we're familiar, you'd expect, but it can send messages back and forth to the main window. So you can take some data, send it off to this web worker, which then processes it in some way and sends the data back, which can then be displayed to the user. So you can do some very impressive long-running calculations in the background without slogging up the user interface, which if you start a big process in JavaScript without doing this, you'll get a user interface just locks up on you. There's also WebSockets. WebSockets allow you to basically do commit, but do it right, where instead of having HTTP calls going back and forth, you actually have genuine bidirectional communication. And it's also nice because the overhead is much less. You don't have to establish a full HTTP connection to send 3 characters. You can just send a very minimal envelope.
So how much of the book, I'm looking here at the page of the book, it's about 300 pages estimated. How much do you devote to the WebSockets in the bi direction. I've been a little bi curious for many years. I'm wondering how deep you go into that.
Not as deep as I would like. I'm hoping before the book hits publication to add to that a little, because the problem with WebSockets is that just what you can find out there is so sparse.
Sure.
That.
Just read the source. I'm saying that facetiously, of course.
Yes, of course.
And I think you're probably touching somewhat on the problems of tech publishing in general. And I publish monthly tech journals, one on JavaScript, and just trying to keep up month to month and make sure that content is relevant and current is difficult enough. And I think a focused book, I'm sure this has taken you many months to work on and compile. You're constantly, I'm sure, dealing with, well, this is changing, this is changing, this is changing. How have you dealt with that conundrum?
With difficulty. I mean, parts of it have been gone back and rewritten. I think we started it around September last year. So there's, it's been a while.
And certainly for a 300-page book for one author, you've done quite a lot. It's actually
The 300-page count was the initial guess. It actually worked out to about 150. So.
Oh, okay. Well, you're slacking that. Then you're slacking.
Slacking. I've been bugging my editor to fix that, actually.
Sure.
This is actually one of a bunch of books on HTML5 that is coming out from O'Reilly.
Just use bigger fonts. Just use big fonts. It'll be a 300-page book in no time. I'd like to, if I may, steal Manuel's thunder for a moment or two, maybe three. I'd like to go back through the mists of time to Boston, back to your youth, and have you describe for us a little bit about what your background with computers is and how you got into programming, and specifically how you got into JavaScript and what you're doing with it today. And you can probably answer quicker than I ask the question, but I always like to know people's background.
So let's see. I grew up in Boston. To go back, I'll just sort of start with the real beginning. My mother, when she was in university in about 1970, actually was programming in Lisp. And I'll come back to Lisp in a minute.
Okay. Don't we all, really?
Oh, well, JavaScript is a Lisp language.
That's what I'm saying. Don't we all? We all come back to it.
Yeah,
it was insightful. It was insightful.
Yeah. When I was about 7 years old, my mother told me if I could get half the money, she'd buy me a computer. She didn't expect me to actually do it. I called every relative I could think of and asked for money. I was seven. Give me a break.
Okay. Yes. Quite enterprising. I'll beg. Yes. That's fine. That's fine.
It was a Radio Shack Color computer. It had 16 kilobytes of RAM.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You're talking my language. I understand what you mean.
And mine,
too.
Yes, you're amongst old people here.
Yeah, no kidding. And it had, in those days, computers booted up to BASIC. So I learned BASIC. I'm not permanently scarred by it, apparently.
You're fine.
Did some Pascal in high school. Played with a few other languages along the way. When I hit university, I started as a computer science major. And at the time, Brandeis University, for your first class, dropped you into Structured Interpretation of Computer Programs. One of the great all-time books on computer programming. If you've not read it, you should do so now.
Well, I'll talk to you guys later then. I'll wait.
I love that book. I have a copy 20 years later still on my shelf. And started out as a computer science major. Discovered I liked physics a lot better. Bugged out to the physics department. Dropped out of university around 93. I worked in the dot-com boom in Boston for a while. Lived in London, worked in high-tech in London for a while, because I could. And then when the dot-com boom crashed in 2001, week after 9/11, I lost my job. Went back, finished my university degree, moved to Israel, and somewhere along the line, moved in terms of professional programming, went from Perl in the old days, in the 90s, to PHP, and then really picked up JavaScript over the last 4 or 5 years, maybe 6.
So you've been over in Israel for a long time. You're coming up on 10 years now.
Seven. I came here.
It'll be
eight this summer.
Okay. Well, you're coming up on 10. Just don't move for a couple of years. Okay.
Not going anywhere. So.
Okay, because I don't know sometimes when we have guests or either on this podcast or other times that I interview people, I never quite know what their background is, and you don't make me feel old. Other people make me feel very old because they start off with, well, my first year in high school, I took a web programming course, and I did this, and you know, it's just, it's insane. Well, and
I remember when I was in university, this was about 1993, I was sitting in the apartment I was renting with my roommate. And we figured out how to make an HTML form. But we couldn't quite figure out what to do with it, how you submit it.
Yeah.
My first web application was, again, 93, 94 timeframe, written in Perl. I think Perl 5 had just come out. And MySQL didn't exist yet. We were using MSQL.
Yep. From hughes.com.au, I bet, huh?
Yep.
Okay. Yes. All the old fogies know what we're talking about.
Yeah, the young people are going, what are they talking about? I can honestly claim that I've been on the internet programming the World Wide Web since rocks were soft and dirt was a fresh new idea.
There you go. So certainly, I like to understand, to know that background with people, and certainly people that have been programming longer than I have. It sounds like our age and careers are fairly similar. But I'm sure you've seen a lot of stuff, and Manuel's seen it, and I've seen it. Been doing web stuff. We saw the first iteration, the mid to late 90s. JavaScript wasn't there, then it was there, then it was a joke, then it was broken everywhere, incompatible DOMs. And 5, 6, maybe 7 years ago, we started to see a coalescence around some standardization, and then some of the toolkits like YUI and jQuery started to make abstraction over all the differences, a much more palatable approach. Those plus certainly faster computers.
The JavaScript engines in Chrome and Firefox and IE and et cetera have just gotten so much better.
Right.
You know? Oh, yeah. All of those. The stars aligned and it's all been getting better over the past several years. One thing builds on another now. Faster engines, faster CPUs, multiple cores. And some adoption. I think the big thing to me has been the lessening of Microsoft's dominance. And that's not to say that they haven't. They've certainly done things like introduced Ajax and brought some good ideas. But when you've got multiple competitors all mostly in a friendly way competing with each other, but adopting the good ideas such that, you know, if I'm going to do, I think WebWorkers initially, my understanding was. The Google Gears plugin, that was one way of doing it. Someone else had another way, and everybody over the past few years has adopted this is the standard way. So if I run it, if I write to that loose spec, it's going to work on maybe it doesn't work on IE7, but it's going to work on some of the rest of the browsers, modern browsers. So I think the Microsoft in some corners still has a majority share in some cases, but I think they're rapidly becoming just the largest minority in most cases. So no one has a dominant thing, and it's in everybody's interest now to accommodate and adopt all of these new technologies so they're not left behind.
And what's really nice is actually the WebKit browsers, of which is Chrome and Safari, basically.
Mm-hmm.
On mobile are really the dominant thing because the Android and iPhone browsers are based on WebKit. So HTML5 is actually probably got better penetration on mobile phones than it does on desktops for a variety of reasons having to do with the fact that most people replace their mobile phones more often than they do their desktops.
Sure.
Right. So commenting or... Just because earlier you mentioned Google Docs as an example of an application that uses HTML5.
I'm not actually sure how much HTML5 they have, but it's certainly...
Yeah, well, I just read somewhere, I do not recall where, that actual Google Docs is not ready to work offline currently, and they are working on it to make it happen soon, probably months.
Oh, cool.
Because I already tried to unplug my network to see what happened, and basically it got stuck. So it was not... although it may detect that it became offline, it still depends on being online to keep saving your changes.
Yeah, taking an application offline is actually fairly challenging to do it well, because you need to do this two parts. You need to first of all keep local copies through offline ability of all of the files that you might have as part of your application, all the JavaScript, all of the CSS, the images, everything else. That needs to be cached offline through the manifest file. And then right. You need to have also it be able to deal with storing its data in an offline storage. Now, the problem with that is you have local storage and session storage, which just basically appear like a persistent JavaScript object. You put data in them and it stays there. It's kind of nice. But you also had a SQL standard, which was being proposed for a while, which seems to be going away. And it's been called IndexedDB, which is a NoSQL solution, sort of similar in idea to, you know, a CouchDB or a MongoDB, in broad outline at least. But that seems like it's very inconsistent. Chrome has it, Firefox has it, but they're not compatible with each other, near as
right.
I can tell.
It's a bit early.
So, you know, IndexedDB I think will be really cool in about 2013. But now in 2011, I would not recommend using it for anything more than just experimentation.
Right. Well, what I was going to ask regarding your book is, I understand that you have probably one or more chapters on offline work, because it is one of the main advantages of the... We keep calling it HTML5, but in reality, just JavaScript APIs.
Right. I mean,
it's not exactly HTML.
HTML5 is one of these great buzzwords like AJAX and DHTML that
exactly.
doesn't really mean anything specific.
Yeah.
It's a collection of a bunch of new interfaces for JavaScript, which is really what my book talks about.
Right.
Some new CSS stuff, which is really cool, but my book doesn't touch it at all. There's some new HTML tags, which, again, I don't really talk, you know, I sort of glance over a few of them, but other books will cover that. In terms of applications, really what's interesting is you have a bunch of new interfaces, the offline, the local storage, the web workers, and the web sockets that allow you to really just build applications. I don't know if it's possible today, but I suspect a year from now, you will see some real graphics packages, something in the, you know, Illustrator or Photoshop variety, done in a web browser, which would just be really cool. You know, where you can build SVG graphics again, like you would in, you know, a desktop application, but in your browser, and have all the browser advantages to it. You know, it automatically updates. You can save it to the cloud. You can
so I'll have another program that I can use to be horribly crappy visually at. Be yet one more way for me to express the fact that I can't draw or design or illustrate. And now I can do it in the browser. I can do it in the browser. I can be mobile while I do it. Sweet.
But on the other hand, somebody like my wife, who's a graphic designer, can do cool things with it. My ability with graphics programs is I can launch GIMP, take a screenshot, and crop it to maybe draw an arrow on it to say, hey, look at this thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm sending somebody a screenshot for a bug report or something, which I do every so often. But that's about my limit. HTML5 has a whole bunch of different stuff in it. This book just really was intended to cover the application side of things. I think it's a compelling story.
Let me ask maybe a little bit more about the compellingness of some of the sections. This really speaks to what you do. How much of what you cover in the book is something that you do on a daily basis? And that's not meant to be maybe put you in a bad position, but maybe I rephrase this. Are there some specific technologies that you cover in the book that you find yourself maybe you were already doing before you started the book, or you're already doing on a regular basis? things like the offline work, things like WebSockets, things like that. What do you use on a daily basis?
Okay, well, I do a lot of JavaScript, just in general. A lot of functional JavaScript. I treat JavaScript as a functional programming language, much like, say, Haskell, more than I do as an object-oriented language. There's a whole section on that. There's a section in the book, actually, which is not specific to HTML5, on JavaScript testing in Selenium.
I lost you. I don't know if you're there.
Documented. What?
I lost you after object-oriented. You talk about Haskell, and then you said you had a section on object-oriented.
Yeah, so I personally feel JavaScript works better in some ways if you treat it like a functional language than if you do as an object-oriented language. The truth of the matter is that one of the things that JavaScript got really right is the function. Functions in JavaScript are really powerful. And really, if you know from Lisp what a lambda is, a JavaScript function is a lambda, really. It doesn't use the word lambda. Is that better?
Yeah. Yes.
And so functions are really the thing JavaScript got right. And then in more recent versions, the array operations, things like map and filter, and those are just really nice. So for map, if you're not familiar with it, map takes an array, a list, and a function, and it applies the function to every element of the array that returns the array of what the function returned. So if you want to process a list of elements for some reason, which is a pretty common thing to do, you just create a very small function. I tend to write a lot of code that tends to have four or five maps sort of chained together, each with a one-line function in it, or a two-line function that does something really simple. Four or five very simple transforms, so that when you look at the code, you can just sort of obviously see, oh yeah, this is, doing what I want it to do, which is really nice.
And my guess is that the byproduct of that, maybe not for JavaScript so much, but the byproduct of writing much more smaller chunkable code is testability, either an automated test or from I just want to make sure this one thing does its thing. It's also interesting you're talking about the mapping there, because we've had this in PHP for donkey's years, as they say in England, array walk, but the procedural syntax of PHP is such that I don't think that style ever really caught on in PHP. It's there, and people use it sometimes, but I don't think it's as central to people's program design as mapping and iterative constructs are in other languages, probably partially because just the core syntax and you should say the chainability and things like that.
I was using array map in PHP yesterday, so...
Again, not saying it doesn't happen, but it's... You look at most of the PHP books out there, it's just something that is commonly used.
I mean, I do it in PHP because I spend 80% of my day in JavaScript doing this kind of stuff. So when I switch to PHP, it just makes sense to use the same ideas I've already been using. So basically it's a section on power of JavaScript. I talk about jQuery and then XJS from Sentia, which is a really, if you're trying to write application level stuff in JavaScript and are willing to deal with the library, it's a little bit on the heavy side in terms of downloads, really one of the best library toolkits out there. It's great. I love it. Really well documented.
One thing I wanted to ask, now that you mentioned some frameworks, is that if in your book you cover any framework support to HTML5 specific features?
Yeah, I do actually. I talk about a couple of the jQuery extensions to deal with stuff, to do some of those things.
Right. I think that's interesting because even more with jQuery, which is usually popular, most people will be interested in those aspects because they are already getting used to so much to that framework.
Well, one of the things about JavaScript is it is a Lisp language. And if you ever talk to the old-time Lisp guys, what you'll discover what they do is Lisp is a very dynamic language, and they'll sort of build up Lisp till it gets to the problem domain. But you can do that with JavaScript as well. I mean, jQuery is really this wonderful syntactic extension to JavaScript that really just makes JavaScript much nicer to use. If you're familiar with functional programming and Haskell, and you've read about monads, jQuery is actually more or less similar to a Haskell monad. If you have no idea what that means, don't worry about it. It's not.
Wasn't he the guy on Leave It to Beaver?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a little before my time.
Oh, come on. You had reruns in Boston.
Okay, we did. Not that.
Okay.
So the other thing we talk about sort of been had half a chapter on, or a chapter on, is testing, both with QUnit, which is from the guys who did jQuery, and then with Selenium. Selenium is a great tool. I have a huge suite of tests using Selenium at work that I actually wrote the chapter and the tests at the same time. So I was literally going home from work, writing documentation on how to use Selenium, going to work the next day, printing it out, and making sure it made sense as I was trying to write tests.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It was kind of fun, entertaining experience. I'm writing the documentation I'm using at work in real time.
I'm curious if you're talking about testing. Certainly Selenium's been around for many, many years. I'm wondering if you have tested out or used Zombie and Vows together. Zombie, the fast, headless, full-stack testing system, and then Vows, a behavior-driven for Node.js. We saw a presentation on that at a recent user group, and I was impressed, almost impressed enough to actually set something up to run it, but I don't have enough time to get all those tools set up because I'm too busy testing stuff by hand. So now I sound like everybody else has ever given me an excuse for not testing.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with those. If you could send me a link, I'd love to check them out. Let's put them in the show notes, I guess.
Sure. The interesting thing is Vows and Zombie, they kind of work hand in hand, but because they're running in Node.js, which itself is JavaScript, you have a lot of the power of JavaScript, but it's running out like Selenium might and grabbing a page, but it can run all of the JavaScript on that page because it's running in JavaScript. It is JavaScript. So for those that aren't doing server-side JavaScript yet, that might be one more reason to take a look at specifically Node, just because those are some pretty good tools already put together.
What is the name of it?
One is called VowsJS, VowsJS.org. That is a behavior-driven development tool for Node, and Zombie, ZOMBIE.js. That's at zombie.labnotes.org.
Okay, so, we'll add
a
link in the show notes. So you said before you expect this to go to print in September, right? And,
should be August, September timeframe, yeah, that's what they're telling me.
Right, and so for those that would be interested to purchase the book, they can pre-order the print version, and if I got it right from the page here, we'll put also the link to the book page in the O'Reilly site in the show notes.
But they can
already get the digital version?
Yeah, you can get the early release ebook now. And
does that mean that if they get it now, they will get an update when it's...
Yeah, well, you get an update, and that's in EPUB, MOBI, and PDF format. And I believe there is no digital rights management on that. You can also, if you have a Safari Books Online subscription, you can find it there.
I guess this is interesting. I already got some books from the Safari site.
Oh, I love my Safari.
And,
I love Safari.
Right, O'Reilly has been kind enough to send us review copies for any books, and let me also remind anybody that would like to review any books from O'Reilly and eventually other publishers, we may even eventually get free review copies so they can write the reviews, and we have a section in JS Classes site to publish those reviews. So, Zach, it was great to know about your book, and we wish you best of luck with
Thank
it.
Thank you.
I already published a book many years ago, and I know it's hard to succeed somehow whatever success means to you. I certainly did not get rich with it. Maybe it's not your primary goal for a first book, but I don't know if you have previous books.
No, this is my first, although I am planning a second already.
You know, that's good. That's good to know, because writing books takes people with dedication, and I hope to hear from you any future books on JavaScript. We certainly have space in JS Classes site to talk about it, and also eventually in a future podcast.
Thanks. Actually, the next book probably won't be on JavaScript, but we'll be definitely on web topics. So.
Yeah, okay, but moving on to with our podcast, now I'd like to mention a few subjects of interest of those that are following the latest news in the JavaScript world. I've been meaning to mention this in previous episodes, but I ended up not being able to fit in the schedule, but I'll do it now. One thing that I'd like to mention is the sources of where you can get the latest news about JavaScript. So I gather here an interesting collection of new sources of JavaScript. First, I'd like to mention that the JS Classes site blog, and on which the Lately in PHP podcast is included, is aggregated by the Planet JavaScript site, which is one of those Planet-like aggregator sites. The Planet JavaScript is managed by Michael Girard. I'm not sure if I'm spelling his name correctly, but I'll make sure that in the show notes I'll post a link to the Planet JavaScript, and also mention his name correctly.
No, it's Mike Girard. Okay, I didn't know he was doing this.
Yeah,
I did not know he was. I did not know he was. Is he managing it, or is he just on it?
Well, I think it just aggregates the domain, and that's it. He aggregates several sources.
Sure.
Some of the most obvious, like the jQuery blog and the YUI blog. And
I think he needs to get the JS Mag blog on there, too. And I say that because Mike Girard was a speaker at last year's IndieConf, which I'm going slightly off topic, but I knew him in one context. I did not know him in the context of Planet JavaScript. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, well, I think it probably also make sense for you to contact him and also have aggregated another source of news about JavaScript that you have in your JSMag site, which is your JSMag news roundup that David Calhoun, right, is managing it.
Yep. Go ahead. You have
a piece of JavaScript news here that I just saw came over Twitter today. So it says, Yahoo looking at the possibility of dropping PHP in favor of JavaScript on the server, from Doug Crockford.
Well,
he would say that, wouldn't he? Doug Crockford is gleefully ripping his hands together to try to get rid of PHP. That's how I'm reading it. Would you agree?
Oh, I certainly would be.
Okay. I just want to put words in your mouth.
I mean, personally, if you told me I didn't have to do PHP anymore, I'd be pretty happy. It's a decent language. You can get stuff done in it, but I would not describe PHP as elegant in any way, shape, or form.
Everybody agrees, I think.
It's functional, though. Or it's not functional. It's pragmatic.
Pragmatic. The language, I got to say, the two languages that I've started looking at recently that have really rocked my world are CoffeeScript is starting to get real interesting. Looking at that. I haven't done anything with that. And
I agree.
The language I'm really getting excited about is Erlang.
Hey, 1983 called. They want their hot new technology back.
You know something? It does concurrency right. Actually,
it does concurrency. Okay, that's a good thing. I don't want to fight you over it. That's just you saying that.
Okay, it does concurrency as well as anything, which isn't saying very much because concurrency is hard. But it's a pretty cool. It's got some pretty cool features in it. Haskell also is starting. Is something that I've been trying to learn, although it kind of breaks my brain. Haskell's type system breaks. I like it, but it breaks my. I can tell it's really cool, but it breaks my head. I think I need to spend more time on it.
Maybe. I've gone down the route of, and I've seen other people do this too, where they think something is really awesome because other people talk about it and it's got a history, and they say, well, if other people like it, it must be awesome, and I'm just not worthy. I'm just not talented enough. Sometimes that's the case, and sometimes it's just, no, those people just have really weird ideas about what's good, and maybe they live in academia, maybe they live in a world where they don't actually have to ship stuff. Yeah, and that's, I'm not saying PHP is totally awesome in all respects, but it still holds on partially because it's there. I mean, the notion of a degree of pragmatism wins out. And that's PHP. Ruby as well has its place, and Python, and the standard languages that everybody knows have a benefit in that,
oh, certainly.
That kind of, traditionally, if you get hit by a bus tomorrow, I'm not trying to be morbid here, but you know, that notion of could somebody else come and take over the project. Sometimes you want someone else to be able to take over the project. You don't want to work there anymore.
this is definitely a concern that, you know, some of the more obscure languages, and some of them are really nice. I mean, I think a friend of mine who's probably one of the smartest programmers I know has been ranting about Scala for the last year. I looked at it enough to think, yep, that looks like it's got some pretty cool features in it, and played with it for an afternoon once. The problems with any of these languages is, in order to get good at a programming language, and I don't care what language it is, you need to write, in my opinion, about 2,000 lines of code. And that just takes time. I mean, you got to just find the time and sit there and write out code and have it not work and fix it and realize you did it in a way that makes, that is just, yeah, it works, but that's really stupid, and rewrite it. And, you know, that just takes time. And I'd say you have
to go even further with a framework of some sort. And I will throw out my pitch for Groovy and Grails, which I still occasionally have issues with people saying, well, I couldn't use that. It's too obscure. It compiles down to JVM. It's pretty standard. It's a JSR standard. It's pretty standard. That said, I've been working with it for about 3 years now, and it's probably only been the last year, 6 months maybe, that I've felt competent with it, that I felt comfortable and competent with it. But that's the language and the framework. I mean, you could say, I know Scala, but then do you understand Lyft? Lyft is evolving, so you're kind of dealing with, am I learning it right? Oh, they're changing the APIs. And that's not taking on Lyft. It's the nature of tech in general. 2,000 lines, for me, I would need more than 2,000 lines. For me, minimally, I would need a year of doing multiple projects to feel comfortable deploying something to production.
I mean, the truth of the matter is I had reason the other day to look at code in the project I work in that was written about 3 years ago, back when it was a fairly new project in JavaScript. And I was cringing. Oh my God, I wrote that?
Yep.
It was really bad. You know, compared to what I write now.
I've got stuff like that I've done a year ago that, ashamed is too strong a word, but I'm certainly not happy with it, not proud with it. Because I've discovered a lot more practical ways of doing testing, of separation of concerns, front end, back end. I'm more comfortable with that. But as with probably you face this, Manuel, you face this, do you have time to go back and refactor stuff? And you have to figure the opportunity cost. Is it really worth it to go back and refactor those six modules only for my convenience and for my peace of mind? Is it going to bring any more money? Am I going to get paid for it? All those things we wrestle with.
And the truth of the matter, in this case, the answer was, no, it really isn't. I mean, it's code that works. It may not look pretty, but it gets the job done, whatever job it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, it looks ugly, and I'm going to cringe a little. But, I mean, that's just life.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure if I switched tomorrow from JavaScript to doing CoffeeScript is probably not the best example, because it's fairly similar to JavaScript.
If you start doing Scala tomorrow, that's probably a good example. If you did Scala.
Right. I'm sure I could get to the point in a week where I was getting things done. It doesn't mean getting them done well, but, you know, it would compile, it would run, it would do whatever it was supposed to do.
Right.
You know, 6 months later, I'd come back and look at that code and go, oh, my God. But that's just, you know, if 6 months later you come back and look at the code, you don't go, oh, God. you know, something is wrong. It means you haven't learned anything in that 6 months, and that's a, you know, that's a bigger problem.
Yeah. Well, I'm that way with JavaScript. I didn't mean to hijack this whole thing about the meta-ness of programming, but I'm very similar with a lot of the JavaScript I do. Because I do everything, I don't do JavaScript full-time. I spend a few weeks on some front-end piece, and I'm either using YUI, which is what I use a lot, or I might try something new. I end up learning something new, either about a framework or a new technique or something. So I feel like I've progressed, but I don't keep the momentum going. And then I'm back doing database stuff, or I'm back doing whatever. And then I understand JavaScript. I know it, and I can appreciate a lot of the stuff. I just don't feel like I'm a master at it, and I may never be. And I have to just learn to content myself with that. But I have masters around me that I can go ask.
Right. We went a bit away from the original schedule, talking about topics related with languages.
Crack the whip.
But back to the track, I was mentioning the eventual sources of news that the listeners may want to follow. And besides the Planet JavaScript, which aggregates quite a bunch of interesting news sources, as well the JS Mag news roundup that David Callahan puts up in the JS Mag site that Michael manages. There is also one interesting newsletter that I found out recently.
From Peter Cooper, that one?
Right, named JavaScript Weekly. I was not aware about it, just found it recently, and it publishes quite an interesting bunch of news, summary of the latest happenings in the related with JavaScript. It is put together by Peter Cooper, and from what I could gather, it is only available if you subscribe to the newsletter. So you'll get it via email. There is no web version, from what I understood. And if you are onto these JavaScript-related topics that you want very much to follow, you may want to also subscribe to this newsletter. I did not see any commercial motivation for it. It seems to be an effort that Peter puts up weekly to get a summary of news, and it's all that the newsletter has. There is no advertising on it on anything else. And now moving on to other topics that I was hoping to talk about in this this podcast. There is one interesting article that actually I put together just a few days ago regarding this eventual browser war that still goes on, but from the point of view of the web developers. It is an article that I published actually in the PHP classes site. Despite it is not specific to PHP, it talks about browsers. And what I did is actually get some figures of browser adoption of the users of the site. The site is quite big. Recently it reached 1 million registered users. And there are about, I would say, probably 40,000 that come to the site at least once a month. And using the statistics of the users that get to the site at least in the last 30 days, there is a statistics page that shows the actual share that each browser has. And basically, what it revealed is that there is this trend of growth among PHP developers in this case, but I think we can extend it to developers of the other languages for web programming, is that there is this trend of growing of Chrome, which practically doubled its almost doubled its share since last year.
I see. Yeah, that's a big jump.
Yeah.
That is a big jump.
Despite Firefox continues to be the dominant browser for web developers, with still almost 60% of the share, while Chrome is getting near to 30%, and practically the rest is an Internet Explorer that got below 10%. Now is about 9%, and that is an interesting thing to produce some reflections about what these numbers mean. And for me, this article I wrote to somehow vent some frustrations about the Chrome browser, because it's nowadays is my it's the browser that I use to access the web in general, not specifically to develop web applications, websites, but to access any other sites. And but when it turns out to do some web development in specific, there are some frustrations that I enumerate in the site: deficiencies, limitations. I thought that some of the things that I sort of complaining were maybe things that I missed. Probably there is some one extension that implements some aspect that I missed, and that the Firefox browser provides a good solution. But after seeing the comments that people have posted there, this time I got quite a great bunch of comments, over 40 comments, which is not usual for blog posts in the PHP Classes site blog. And some people supporting what I was saying regarding the frustrations with Chrome for web development, and other people just supporting Chrome, saying that I was not getting the point. And there is still a minority of people that were not supporting neither Firefox nor Chrome, but rather Opera, and because they probably are long-time fans of that browser. I don't know if you guys have read that article. What did you think about it?
I liked it, but I got to say, you missed my two favorite points in favor of development in Firefox. I think Firebug is a somewhat better debugger in most respects than Chrome's DevTools, but Chrome's DevTools are also really good, but I just am more used to Firefox. But the tool that I've not found an equivalent for in Chrome, Selenium, I use the Selenium IDE, not as a test tool, but as a macro recorder. Mm-hmm. So when I'm doing development, I'll often be working on something, or to get to what I'm working on, you have to, you know, click five or six different places on the screen. Sort of speed that up. I'll have the IDE open in a corner with a little script in it that does those clicking, you know, click here, type a number there, click this button, you get the picture. And that way, when I actually want to reload the page and test it again, whatever I've changed, I develop in Linux. I switch to an Xterm, hit a little shell script I have that syncs all my code over to the server, and then automatically clicks the appropriate button on the IDE, Selenium IDE. So I then just run the tool, and it gets to me to the place I'm working. So if you're, for example, working on, say, a wizard where you have three or four screens, which certainly is not a crazy thing to be working in.
No.
It clicks you through the first three screens till number four, if that's what you happen to be, you know, trying to fix the problem in. I find that saves me oodles of time at work.
Right. It's an interesting point. I did not think about it. I knew about Selenium, but I never imagined that it could be a good thing for recording macros, and have it used for repetitive tasks, I think. Michael, you were saying something about this article.
Well, I was starting to. I thought I'd written a comment, and I don't see my comment there now. Maybe it's there, maybe it's not. You mentioned something about Flash crashing. I'm wondering to some extent if that's you're more of a Linux guy. I've had Flash crash browsers, but it does it on Chrome and Firefox and Safari. It's equal opportunity. I don't know if maybe it's worse in some distros on Linux than others.
Right. The matter is that it doesn't crash in Firefox. It's just a Chrome-specific problem. And it's in the recent versions. It did not use in the past versions. I think it's probably something due to the built-in inclusion of Flash support in the Chrome distribution. Maybe. You just don't download Flash or use a separate distribution. Yeah. I think that's probably something. It's probably something that Chrome people are aware, and maybe it's specific with Chrome on Linux. But
that's what you use. Yeah,
It doesn't matter because what matters is that it crashes, and when you go to places that use Flash, not that I like Flash, but that developed those sites decided to use Flash. In this case, it was actually Google, because I mentioned Google Analytics and Webmaster Tools.
Yeah.
They use Flash, and it precisely crashes on the exact pages that I want to see, and it becomes really frustrating. It's not something that was so important, because I do not use those applications all the time, but when I do it, it crashes. And just to mention that Firefox does not crash, at least in those situations. I don't know what Chrome did different, but it was just to add yet another frustration with Firefox, with Chrome, that I do not have with Firefox.
Well, good for you, because I have crashes and everything. But it's equal opportunity for me.
Okay. Well, anyway, this was an interesting article from the point of view that it raised a lot of interest from the community to express their opinions. And since it was mentioned, it was posted in the PHP Classes site, the JavaScript developers that are not so much onto the PHP world maybe not aware. It was just a way to let them know through this podcast to go and read the article. You may find interesting information, also some solidarity about your frustrations with Chrome. But moving on with our podcast now towards the end, we'll get back to the usual sections. First, the latest objects.
I'll jump in here first off, because recently, I'm trying to look for the date. I don't see a date offhand, but one of the more recent contributions looks to be something called GMAP 3, which is a jQuery plugin for creating and using Google Maps. And I have to say, I've done Google Map embedding a couple of times just using raw sample code and tweaking it a bit. And the GMAP 3 object, or really a set of code here, looks to be a little bit more friendly. There's some things that it provides. There's the documentation. You can download it from jsclasses.org, but there's also a link to a full page with downloading and documentation and all that as well there. It's one of the better documented pieces of code I've seen in a while in terms of JavaScript stuff, at least from an independent person. Certainly, the large teams, the jQuery's and the toolkits, have a lot of documentation. But this in of itself is pretty nice. One of the things that I really liked about it was the clustering, the ability to say, here's a bunch of points, and it will automatically scale the map to include all of them. So if you have everything in one city or one town, the map will only be that big. If you have everything going across an entire state or country, it will keep the scale of the map accordingly. Again, Google does that for you. You can tell it how to do it, but the GMAP 3 system just makes it easier, I found. And that was from, let me see if I can say this right without sounding insulting here, Jean-Baptiste Demont, I hope I said that without hurting Franco-American relations. He's from France. I'm assuming it's a he. Jean-Baptiste sounds like a male name. So, merci, Jean-Baptiste.
Right. It's an interesting object, actually. In this case, it is a jQuery plugin. And, right, just like you mentioned, the clustering feature is something that Google Maps leaves out to developers to implement. They can add an overlay to a Google Map object and do whatever they want to somehow display markers in a more convenient fashion. In this case, the clustering solves the problem of performance. When you have too many markers on the map, it somehow reduces the time to display them, because if many markers are on top of each other, they just show a single marker and a number of letting the user know how many markers it is aggregating in that space. Personally, I've been using some other JavaScript code to implement clustering, and because Google does not provide a default clustering solution, you have to implement it yourself, and this turns out to be quite useful. But moving on, Zachary, do you would like to mention any object that you would like?
The autocomplete object here looks kind of neat by Roy Yu. I haven't had a chance to actually play with it yet, but having an easy interface to doing autocomplete in an input form is one of those things that's just sort of generically useful if it's done well. And like I said, I haven't actually played with this yet, so but it looks really nice. It looks like it could be quite good. So that would be my choice out of the new entries.
Right. It's also a jQuery plugin.
Right.
I also would like to highlight another autocomplete. Well, it's not just autocomplete. Also jQuery plugin that lets you not only autocomplete selections from on forms with select inputs, but also perform selection of multiple entries, and it does it in a way that I think it's more user friendly, as it displays some entries that get added to the list of selections from possible options that may exist. And it also has the possibility to narrow down the search for options that you want to select when there are too many options, and by just reducing the list of options to those that match the initial set of characters that you type in a text input. And once you added an option, it shows the option that you added below. And if you want to remove it, there is a sort of a remove button that you can click. And I think it's more user-friendly than the usual way that select inputs work. So if you want to deselect just one option, usually you have to hit the control key and point to the option that you have selected. And I think for many users that is not so obvious. And this solution, in this case, was provided by Imran Ahmed. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. He's from Bangladesh.
Yeah.
It's quite a user-friendly solution. But I think we cover quite a few interesting objects so far. Unfortunately, you do not have to comment more about the others that have been published recently, because we have to move on to the next regular section of our podcast, on which Michael covers the latest articles in the upcoming issues of the JS Mag magazine. Michael,
that's called buying myself a few moments while it loads up. Upcoming JS Mag, I will throw this out before I even get to this, is constantly always looking for new and good and interesting content. And summertime sometimes seems to be even a little bit more challenging because of the Northern Hemisphere people with their summer vacations and all that. We had seven things lined up, and I had a bunch of people that through personal circumstance and other obligations have dropped out. So there's a few that I can't mention this month, and I'll mention for next month. But we should have second part in a series from Vincent Goff about writing native Android and iOS phones using JavaScript. We have a piece from Christopher Bergdorf. He's a new author with us, and it's talking about the reactive extensions for Microsoft. And we have Dino Gambone, who had actually found JS Mag and became an author through this podcast. So thank you very much, Manuel. Writing continuing a game development series with Node.js. And there was one other piece, which I don't have listed here right now. And then we will have a news highlight from David Calhoun, kind of an overarching wrap-up of what's going on. So that's what's going on there. We have a couple more things slated, hopefully, for next month, possibly more with Ringo.js and server-side development, and possibly some work with Require.js as well, too. And maybe even a nice little piece from Zach Kessen, maybe something that didn't quite make the book, didn't quite fit, but he feels a need to contribute, because that would be really awesome. But as I mentioned before, and I mentioned again, we pay for content. We pay. You keep the copyrights. We ask for typically 90 days to be the first publisher of something, but you get to work with one of our editors, so you get some professional feedback as to how to make something better, how to get your point across. If English is not your first language, don't worry about it. That's a pretty common thing we deal with. So go to jsmag.com and take a look, and if you're interested, sign up. We'll get you started.
Right, I think from what Zach was telling me, I think he had something about CoffeeScript that he may want to contribute.
That would be awesome.
So for those who don't know, CoffeeScript is a new language that compiles down to JavaScript. It really is almost JavaScript with better syntax, and cleaning up some of the really ugly parts of the language. I can't say I know it. I've played with it for about an hour in between other things, but this
might be a good excuse to dig into it and to write something as either your learning experience about it, things to avoid, things to look out for, things to focus on when you're using it. I'd love a good introduction to CoffeeScript.
Yeah, so would I. There's a couple books coming out from it. I know the Pragmatic Programmer series is working on one. It's in pre-release now. And I expect there would be others.
Speaking of, I'm going to throw out one quick thing because I just saw this the other day. There's a cross-platform library called Foreplay, Forplay. You can find it on Google Code. And this is something that will let you take Java and it will compile it into either a desktop Java app or JavaScript and HTML5 or Android or Flash.
There's another product called Particle Code that's from a company that used to be the same company that used to be the parent company of the company I worked for before we got sold. Particle lets you, I'm not really familiar with the details, but basically
I see it here. Yes, JavaScript or ActionScript. Yeah,
to HTML5 and native for a bunch of different phones. Yep. To a little background, the company I work for, Mytopia. And that company used to be the same company. And then we had one division that was doing social games, Mytopia, which is who I work for, and another company doing this platform technology. And the social games half got sold about a year ago to 888 Holdings, which is an online gaming operation that, well, bought us. So that's what we're part of now. But there's some relationship there.
Cool. But, I did not know about Particle Codes. That looks pretty cool. I'm going to take a look.
Yeah, I you know, it looks cool. I can't honestly say I've used it at all.
I don't mind.
You know, but yeah, it's got some cool ideas in it. I know some of the guys who do it. So
even better. Cool.
Yeah, there's some really cool stuff happening in the world of JavaScript and just the world of programming in general these days. It's a lot of fun.
You know? Right. We always try to cover as much as possible about the latest that has been introduced in the JavaScript world. Unfortunately, just recording once a month, it seems to not be able to keep up with everything, but we try to mention things that we think that are more relevant. Maybe we can get back in a future show and have talk a bit more about CoffeeScript and those other frameworks that you mentioned.
Certainly.
We'll cool. See about it. So basically, we have covered a lot of interesting subjects, but our time is practically ended. I just would like to thank Zachary for coming to this show and give his inputs and also interesting information about his book. I wish you the best of luck with the book. I hope you can publish more books on JavaScript or other related interesting topics. I think for now, it was good to have you here. And
it was good to be here. You can find me on Twitter, by the way, at zkessin, ZKESSIN.
Excellent.
Yes, that's good to know. Well, unless you have anything else to add, I think that's all for now.
Me? Anybody?
Anybody.
I'm going to throw out one thing. I'm going to do a quick promotion for IndieConf because it's almost that time. We are tentatively planning for November 19th, again in Raleigh, North Carolina, as it was last year. But I'm mentioning this right now because we have an open call for presenters, call for speakers. And the focus is web freelancing, but we have a number of different focuses. So we had some legal people, we had some financial people, we had some marketing, but we had some tech people as well. So if there are some good presentations that we had a CSS3 presenter last year, if there's anybody listening that feels that doing something either directly or indirectly about JavaScript as it pertains directly or indirectly to working as an independent web person, as an independent web professional, please go to indieconf.com and submit your paper. We have the call for presenters open until the end of June at this point, so about 4 or 5 weeks from now.
Okay, that's always good to know. For those that can attend, I hope they can make it.
Me too.
It's always interesting to have to know about conferences that cover not just technology aspects, but also other aspects that developers need to handle to manage their professional lives as businesses. And your IndieConf event seems to aim in that direction.
That's what we're trying to do. So, Zach, if you happen to be in the States in mid-November and get to Raleigh, there's a ticket and a lunch with your name on it.
Sounds good. You may have to import the lunch from New York because I don't think there's anything kosher in North Carolina. But
hey, we'll get kosher. You want gluten free? You want vegetarian? You want kosher? We plan for it. So
appreciate that. But we're currently saving up to buy a house, so travel is not quite on the agenda for right now.
Figured it might not. You're halfway overseas, but who knows? You have no idea what the next 6 months are going to bring in your life. So. Same goes to you, Manuel. You have no idea. So.
Yeah. Well, I know that in September I'll be in the U.S., but I think it will be more around the Googleplex. No, but that will be a different topic to mention.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk about that closer to the time, too.
Okay. Well, it was great to have you both. I think that's all for now. Bye.
Excellent. Right. Thanks. Thanks, Zach. Bye-bye, guys.
You're welcome.